You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. The Girl Who Played with Fire by Jesse Hyde, with opening photograph by Christina de Midel. Jane de Oliveira set out to protect the Amazon rainforest from the corporate interests that are burning it to the ground. Then, the armed men showed up. Opening photo, Killing Fields. Fernando Araujo walks through the site of the massacre at Santa Lucia, where he survived by hiding in the brush. The ranch was carved from the Amazon, which continues to be destroyed by wealthy landowners and corporations. And, next photo, Occupy Amazon. Jane de Oliveira led a group of landless activists. She had a way of making you believe the impossible could happen, recalls a relative. The farmers arrived before dusk, setting up camp in the tall grass. There were 25 of them, and for months they had been attempting to occupy a sprawling farm known as Santa Lucia that had been carved from the Amazon rainforest. All around them, the once impenetrable jungle had been reduced to barren pastures, part of an orchestrated campaign by large landowners and multinational corporations to slash and burn their way deeper into the Amazon. Every week, another 40 square miles of the world's largest rainforest, what has long been the most important natural bulwark against climate change, go up in flames. Last year, the fires grew so large that they were visible from outer space. Here, on the ground, in the fading daylight, the farmers strung up hammocks and built a small cooking fire. They were led by a former schoolteacher named Jane de Oliveira, broad-shouldered and pale-skinned, with a wide face and high cheekbones. Oliveira belonged to the Cimterra, a Brazilian social movement that seeks to turn idle farmland over to those who will actually work it. Evidence suggested that Santa Lucia's owner had created the farm by stealing public land. Brazil's constitution required that it be turned over to those without land to make it productive. While the courts debated the matter, Oliveira had led several occupations of the farm, setting up crude encampments built of scrap lumber and tarp. For the farmers, it was a chance to escape the plantation-like working conditions that have long dominated Brazilian agriculture in the Amazon. They dreamed of carving out small plots of their own, where they could grow rice and raise chickens. Unlike the ranchers and miners who were setting fire to the rainforest or clearing it, they would live and work in the jungle without destroying it. Beneath the smoke blanketing Brazil, the Cimterra, along with the country's indigenous peoples, are the Amazon's last line of defense. By occupying the farm, they were also putting themselves in the line of fire. A month before they arrived at Santa Lucia, hired assassins had killed 9 villagers who refused to leave a part of the rainforest coveted by loggers. Less than 2 weeks later, a group of cattle ranchers armed with rifles and machetes had entered an indigenous reserve and tortured members of the Gamela tribe. The message was clear. Those who did not make way for big business would be removed by force. Oliveira had received death threats, and her husband had been shot at by a security guard hired by Santa Lucia's owner. Now, as the sun rose on their first morning in the new camp, the sleeping farmers began to stir. A woman known as Blondie got out of her hammock. The rich smell of coffee, brewing over an open fire, cut through the tropical air, already hot and humid at daybreak. Suddenly, she heard a sound in the distance. It sounded like a car door closing. Perhaps several car doors. Oliveira, who was expecting other members of the Cimtera to join the occupation, asked two young men to go and see who had arrived. Moments later, the men came rushing back, their arrival marked by the rustling of the chest-high grass breaking before them. They were breathless. The police had arrived, and they were headed toward the camp. As the sun continued to rise over the forest canopy, the farmer saw a line of men dressed in black, filing quietly through the grassland. They wore balaclavas and carried rifles. Tumbling from her hammock, Oliveira ran into the jungle with her husband, following the others. Her nightgown flowing behind her. It was the height of the rainy season, and the air hung thick with the scent of a coming storm. From a distance, they could hear the police arriving at the camp, kicking over cooking pots and rummaging through the belongings they'd left behind. Hidden in the forest, the squatter stretched a black tarp above them as the rain began to fall in a torrent. Blondie was terrified. They should keep running, she said, but Oliveira urged calm. The police were not going to follow them into the jungle, especially in such a heavy downpour. What she didn't know, as rain cascaded off the tarp, was that they had already been surrounded. A moment later, she heard the crack of gunfire. Located more than 1,500 miles from Rio de Janeiro, the Santa Lucia farm occupies a remote and lawless area about 30 miles west of the BR-155, a highway that cuts through what was once dense, lush jungle. In the 1990s, as a single mother in her early 20s, Oliveira had moved to the region and found work as a teacher in the nearby municipality of Xingara, the traditional home of the Kayapo and Paracana tribes. The area was undergoing a ghastly transformation. A new railroad had been carved through 550 miles of rainforest to the north, and land speculators had descended on the region to clear-cut the Amazon. Indigenous farmers were stripped of their land, driven off at gunpoint, or tied up and forced to watch as their huts were burned. Wealthy landowners used enormous threshing machines and expensive fertilizers to grow soy, which they loaded onto ships destined for China, while small farmers tilled the ground with wooden plows, eating the beans and yucca they grew. The number of cattle in the region soared from 22,500 to 2.2 million, the country's largest herd. Today, nearly 20% of the region's rainforest has been destroyed, and the top 2% of Brazil's landowners hold more property than all the land in England, France, Germany, and Spain combined. Oliveira arrived in the region just as landless workers were beginning to fight back. By 1997, emboldened by a government decision to redistribute millions of acres of unused farmland, 350,000 families across Brazil had legally obtained land by setting up 1,300 camps on idle estates. But when the Cimtera tried a similar approach in the Amazon, they were met with entrenched resistance from wealthy landowners and the police and judges who protect them. In 2017, the year Oliveira led the occupation at Santa Lucia, Brazil had more murders over land disputes than any other country. The longtime owner of Santa Lucia, Honorato Bobinski, was one of the most powerful and feared men in the region. He built his fortune by clear-cutting timber in the Amazon, despite a law that prohibited logging, and he was widely suspected of occupying public lands without a legal deed. His sawmills and farms soon sprawled across 170 square miles of Brazil, an area four times the size of Paris. Emboldened by Babinski's death in 2013, a group of Simterra occupied the Santa Lucia farm. In nearby Rendenzal, a cowboy boomtown with a large rodeo arena and stores that sell boots and Wrangler jeans, longtime ranchers called it the invasion. A friend of Babinski's speculated that the squatters knew they had little to fear from his eldest son and heir, Honorato Babinski Filho, an actor and model who lived in Rio and liked to post photos of his bronzed body on Instagram. Babinski Filho went to court, requesting that the squatters be evicted, but pressed by the judge, he had a hard time proving that the farm was actually productive. Although he claimed that there were 1,700 cattle at Santa Lucia, he could only produce evidence that 75 had been vaccinated. Nevertheless, the court ruled in his favor, and the squatters were evicted. Over the next 3 years, the farm would be occupied three more times. Each time, the judge ordered the squatters to leave. Next photos, the massacre. Brazilian police patrol the Santa Lucia farm after officers opened fire on squatters in 2017, killing 10. That year, Brazil had more murders over land disputes than any other country. A relative of one of the victims at the funeral in the nearby town of Rendenzal. As the years dragged on, the squatters grew tired of their leader, a man named Ronaldo da Silva Santos, who seemed more interested in enriching himself than in helping the landless. Every Sunday, he would hold a meeting to raise money, recalls Fernando Araujo, a member of the Simterra movement who participated in every occupation at Santa Lucia. At the time, there were about 150 families in the occupation, and he'd ask for money from all of us. He would leave with all this money in a suitcase and say it was for meetings with lawyers. In 2017, frustrated by their lack of progress in the courts, the families fired Santos and held a meeting to find a new leader. One of the squatters raised his hand. He knew of someone with experience leading occupations. It was his aunt, Jane de Oliveira. Her husband, Tonho, had grown up along the BR-155, and like many young men, he had started working for the large landowners known as colonels. His brother, Lico, a hired gunman for local ranchers, had even worked for the late Honorato Babinski, running squatters off the land. In 2012, a friend of Tonho's named Celso invited Oliveira to visit a Simterra settlement on the outskirts of Rendenzal. Covering 1,200 acres, it sat on the abandoned property of a tannery, which had been shut down for operating without a license. Celso needed Oliveira's help. He didn't belong to any organization of landless workers, and he didn't know how to petition the courts for legal guardianship of the land they'd occupied. Oliveira agreed to pitch in. Together, they created a settlement called Nova Conquista, or New Conquest, which soon grew to 156 families. Each squatter farmed a small plot of land and took part in communal work, building fences and sharing supplies. Oliveira, who dreamed of starting a farm with Tonho, fell in love with her new role. She had never been involved in politics, in this sort of community organizing, and I think it gave her a sense of purpose, recalls Jose Vargas, a young attorney who provided the settlement with legal assistance. She was meeting with government officials, holding meetings with hundreds of people. She liked the respect and being known as a leader. When the squatters at Santa Lucia elected Oliveira to lead their occupation, she promised that things would change. Working with Vargas, she set out to prove that the farm was located on public land and the deeds proving ownership were fake. Rather than pocketing money raised by the squatters, she used it to buy food and repair shacks built on the property. In the 4 months she led the encampment, its population grew to 180 families. Jane was very charismatic and very energetic, says Ana Lucia, Liko's wife. She had a way of making you believe the impossible could happen, and that her cause was right. But Oliveira also had her critics. Some in the Simterra movement considered her too confrontational, relying on outdated tactics that only heightened tensions. That March, after a judge once again ruled in favor of the Babinski family, she led a protest of 170 people to block the BR-155, preventing soy and cattle trucks from passing. She agreed to call off the blockade only when the head of the civil police, Antonio Miranda, approached her on the road and made her a deal. If she would clear the highway, he would delay the judge's eviction order, giving them time to file an appeal. A month later, however, Miranda broke his promise. Arriving at Santa Lucia, his men forcibly evicted the squatters, burning their shacks and gardens. Miranda warned Oliveira that the Babinski family had hired a private security firm. "They can act violently against you," he told her, "and I can't do anything to stop them." Most of the squatters fled, scattering to towns along the BR-155. But a small group stayed behind, setting up a new camp on a back road considered public property. The next day, flanked by armed guards, Santa Lucia's owner arrived at the camp. A tractor began to dig a trench to prevent the squatters from entering the farm. Tanjo emerged from the shack that he and Jane had built the night before. Pulling a Glock 380 from his waistband, he pointed it at the guards and demanded they leave. A video of the encounter quickly circulated on WhatsApp. Alarmed, local ranchers agreed that the landless squatters had taken things too far. Something had to be done. Accompanied by Vargas, she visited the police and asked for protection, but they advised her to leave the property. For once, Vargas found that he agreed with the authorities. "I'm so sorry," he told Oliveira. "There's nothing more I can do. The most important thing at this point is not the occupation. It's that you protect your life. My recommendation is you leave the camp." Vargas knew what the police were capable of. In 1996, as a teenager in Rindonçal, he had been sitting in class one day when he heard the news that 19 landless peasants had been killed by police on the BR-155 near the small town of El Dorado dos Carajas. It was the worst massacre of its kind in Brazilian history. Vargas went home that day and told his parents he wanted to become a lawyer to fight for the rights of farmers. But Oliveira decided to return to the camp. "She was very stubborn," Vargas recalls. "I would tell her, there are times when you need to back down. If the police are threatening you, if there are gunmen there shooting at you, it's time to back down." The day after Oliveira asked for police protection, the security guards returned to the camp and fired at the squatters. According to eyewitnesses, the squatters fired back. Most of the group dismantled their shacks and fled, but Oliveira and a dozen others decided to hide in a wooded area on the farm. The next morning, there was another exchange of gunfire, and a guard was injured. Oliveira fled to the Nova Conquista settlement, but tensions grew worse. 5 days later, in another skirmish at Santa Lucia, a guard was killed. An arrest warrant was issued for Oliveira and Tonho, along with 12 other members of the movement. Oliveira felt like she had nowhere to run. Worried that police would hunt her down at Nova Conquista or in Rindonçal, she decided to return to Santa Lucia. If she could recruit enough members of the Simterra, she thought, perhaps they would be safe. The landowners had guards and guns and police. The landless had only their numbers. Oliveira called Fernando Araujo, who had participated in every occupation of the farm since 2013. "Let's go back," she told him. Araujo was staying at his mother's house in Rendon-Sal. He missed the farm, where he'd grown rice and corn and had a coop full of chickens. But as much as he hated living in the city, going back seemed risky. "Isn't it too dangerous?" he asked. "Everyone is coming back," Olivera answered. "Are you going to lose your lot?" The next morning, Araujo and his boyfriend arrived at the entrance to the farm, where they waited along with 40 other squatters. By noon, Olivera and Tanjo still hadn't arrived. Part of the group left, vowing to return the next day, when a truck picking up another 40 members of the movement was also scheduled to arrive. By the time Olivera showed up at Santa Lucia, only 25 squatters remained. Fearing they would be spotted from the road, she led them onto the property. The sun was setting as they pitched their camp in the tall grass, stringing hammocks in the trees. The air smelled of rain. A heavy storm was on its way. Crouched in the forest with the rain thundering down, shielded only by a makeshift tarp, the squatters found themselves surrounded. Araujo was knocked to the ground by his boyfriend, who had been shot. The smell of gunpowder filled his lungs, and his ears rang from the sound of gunfire. Terrified, Araujo lay frozen on the ground, his boyfriend moaning and trembling as he died. Blondie, who had hidden in a thicket of trees, could not see what was happening, but she heard the police approaching. "Lie on the ground, bitch," one of them called out. Olivera was the only woman in the group that police were firing on. Blondie would later testify that she recognized one of the voices as that of Antonio Miranda, head of the civil police. The command was followed by a series of heavy thumps. Autopsy reports would later suggest that some of the squatters had suffered brutal beatings before they were killed. "Whoever runs, dies," the police called out, firing at anyone who tried to flee. "The effing bitch has to die," one of the killers said. "They all have to die." "Run, bitch," an officer shouted. Olivera was shot 9 times, 4 in the back. Blondie assumed she had been beaten so badly that she couldn't move. Other witnesses say she was forced to rise to her knees before she was killed. An officer named Valvadino Miranda da Silva, who had been sent to another part of the farm, was shocked by what he saw when he arrived at the scene of the massacre. Bodies were scattered everywhere. Olivera's body had already turned a ghostly white, drained of blood from an open leg fracture. A few squatters were lying on the ground, still alive. "So," an officer who had taken part in the massacre asked Silva, "what's it going to be?" The most experienced officer on the scene, Raimundo Nonato Lopez, had arrived with Silva. He immediately recognized that they had stepped into a trap. Either they would have to participate in the killing, or they would be killed themselves, reported as casualties of a gunfight with the Cimterra. Silva had gone into shock, so Lopez drew his service pistol and pointed it at Lico, who was lying on the ground. "If you're going to kill me," Lico said, "let me die standing." Lopez and the other officers waited for Lico to rise to his feet. Then they opened fire on anyone still breathing. By then, word had spread of the shooting, and a crowd had gathered in front of the hospital, which had set up a makeshift morgue. Family members who peered through windows saw a sickening tableau. Only the body of Jane de Oliveira lay on a stretcher. The 9 other victims, including Tanjo and Lico, had been dumped in a heap, their arms and legs tangled, blood staining the floor beneath them. By the time doctors finally examined the bodies, 9 hours later, the small concrete room gave off a nauseating stench of death. The police insisted they had acted in self-defense. The squatters, they claimed, had fired on them when they arrived to serve arrest warrants for the killing of the security guard. But the autopsy reports did not match the police version of events. According to an investigation by the Brazilian magazine Piauí, two of the dead were shot in the back, as if fleeing. Six had multiple gunshot wounds to their chest, and two had been shot in the head at close range. The precision of the shots suggested an execution, not a shootout. None of the squatters had any gunpowder on their hands, leading the local prosecutor to conclude that none of them had fired a gun. Survivors also contradicted the police. Jose Vargas tracked down Fernando Araujo, who had hidden in the jungle until the police had left. A federal prosecutor whisked other survivors to a hotel in Rendon-Sau, where they spoke until dawn, providing eyewitness accounts of what had actually happened. Then prosecutors got their biggest break. Under questioning by federal police, Silva broke down. Weeping, he admitted what had happened, including his part in the massacre. "It would have been better if I died there," he said. Days later, Lopez confirmed Silva's version of events. The official story, he admitted, was a lie. "There are strong indications this was an execution," the region's highest-ranking law enforcement official announced at a press conference. 15 police officers were charged in the massacre, but most were allowed to remain on the force. The survivors, meanwhile, were placed in witness protection, along with Lopez and Silva. 2 years later, on a hot afternoon last June, Vargas stood in a field beneath a thatched canopy at the Santa Lucia farm, not far from where the massacre took place. It was the burning season in the Amazon, and 2.3 million acres were about to go up in flames. In a conflagration intense enough to be detected by the European Space Agency, dressed in a T-shirt and Bermuda trunks, Vargas was meeting with 200 landless workers, many of whom live on the farm, tilling small plots and raising chickens or pigs. The land at Santa Lucia and the murders that took place there remain at the center of the battle over the Amazon. The courts have yet to turn over the farm to the squatters, as required by the Brazilian Constitution, and no one has been convicted of the murders of Oliveira and the other farmers. Local landowners have blamed the victims, portraying Oliveira, Tanjo, and Lico as a criminal gang who invaded Santa Lucia by force, a tale that Vargas dismisses as a smear campaign. Oliveira, he says, believed in the rights of the landless worker, and in the end gave her life for the cause. Ever since the massacre, families of the victims have been subjected to a terrifying campaign of intimidation. Black cars with tinted windows have parked outside their homes, and most have fled Rendon-Sau for other parts of Brazil. Vargas was also forced to move his family after he returned home to find open beer bottles on his porch, the windows and doors standing wide open. The week we met, what appeared to be a bomb was left in front of his law office. The message was, "We can get to you whenever we want," he said. We were sitting in a pizza joint in Rendon-Sau, just off the main drag. Vargas, who had a haunted look, seemed jittery, his gray eyes ringed in dark circles. For our safety, he suggested we move to a different restaurant. We were being watched. If there was someone else who would take this case, who could pick up where I am and see it to the end, I would leave, he said. But there is no one else. If I give up, the case will simply die. He knows the odds are stacked against the farmers. Charges are almost never brought against police who murder peasants. Of the 29 officers suspected of killing the squatters at El Dorado dos Carajas, the massacre that inspired Vargas to become a lawyer, only two were sent to prison. But Vargas hopes he will be able to identify whoever ordered the killings at Santa Lucia and bring them to justice. In a sense, it is a murder case in which millions of lives hang in the balance. By defending those who live on the arc of deforestation, the demarcation point where Brazil's agricultural frontier is relentlessly advancing upon the rainforest, Vargas is ultimately fighting to save the Amazon itself. Vargas says he couldn't bring himself to go to Oliveira's funeral or see her body after the autopsy. He hasn't even been able to look at pictures taken after the massacre. That's not how he wants to remember her. Instead, he prefers to think about how she looked when he first met her, when she was full of hope and possibility. His focus has turned to those Oliveira left behind. The courts have ruled that the squatters must be evicted, but Vargas says there is no place for them to go. And so, in all likelihood, they will either return to Santa Lucia once more or occupy another farm, and their battle for the Amazon, one that began long before Oliveira's death, will rage on, like the fires all around them. This story was supported by the Pulitzer Center. publish, or perish. The magazine Kinfolk helped to define the upwardly mobile, Instagram-perfect millennial aesthetic. Off the page, its creators' lives have been somewhat messier. By Lisa Abend. Opening photo, self, published. Nathan Williams, co-founder of the cult lifestyle magazine Kinfolk, in its offices in 2016. And picture perfect, Katie Searle and Williams on a shoot. Kinfolk helped make intentionality a millennial watchword. Before he answers a question, Nathan Williams pauses for longer than is strictly comfortable. He does not run a hand through his strawberry blonde hair, nor does he twist the artfully rustic bronze cuff on his wrist. He does not fiddle with the silk triangle tied jauntily around his neck and dyed the exact shade of dark navy as the rest of his well-tailored ensemble. He does, however, blink slowly. If the question is of a personal nature, he may do this several times, so that initially you read this response as panic, a classic deer-in-the-headlights look. But between blinks, he will hold your gaze, until finally the blinking comes to seem less like protection and more like consideration, a weighing of something, perhaps your trustworthiness, perhaps his own. In this, as in all things, the co-founder of Kinfolk, the magazine that helped to codify and, in the process, became shorthand for a certain kind of Instagram-ready millennial aesthetic for an impressive stretch during the last decade, is acting with intention. "I'm not used to talking about these things," he says, a few pregnant pauses into our conversation about the magazine's complicated history. "I want to make sure I get it right." Kinfolk is famously about intentionality, about a kind of wholesome, slow living that exults in deliberately curated moments, carefully selected objects, and, as its twee tagline once read, small gatherings. Like all lifestyle magazines, it traffics in aspiration, and if, in the past 8 years or so, you have found yourself craving a precisely sliced piece of avocado toast or a laundry line from which to cunningly hang your linen bedsheets in the sun-dappled afternoon, you probably have Kinfolk to thank for it. But the seductions featured on its pages have always been timed and aimed as much at the soul as the body. Through intention, Kinfolk's austerely beautiful pages whisper, lies not just a pretty room or a lovely outfit, but a truer expression of the self, something more meaningful, more, as the marketers now put it, authentic. That there might be an inherent tension in an authenticity that depends on buying the right leather apron or arranging a bunch of wildflowers just so is a notion that does not seem to trouble Williams. But perhaps that is because of the other tensions, the ones that would tear apart the small band of intimates who helped him found the magazine, the ones that would erupt within his own measured soul. It was certainly nothing compared to the trauma that lay ahead, and would strip away the well-curated facade to ultimately reveal who he really was. Because although it would not be accurate to say that the Nathan Williams who started Kinfolk was living a lie, neither was he living in truth. Authenticity, performance, brand, product, myth, reality. When it comes to the 33-year-old Williams, it's unusually difficult to separate the strands. He is unfailingly polite and considerate, possessed of a humility and a lack of guile that seem almost shocking in this age of branding and fake news. And yet he himself is so intensely curated, from his passions to his precisely tailored clothing, that it can be hard to see him as entirely real. "We are the same height and have the same posture," says his friend Frederick Lentz Anderson, fashion director for the Danish magazine Euroman. We're both super slim, but every time I see him, I think, how can that suit fit you so perfectly? There's never a flaw to anything he does. It's like he never slips. Kenfolk's origin story seems just as perfect, a charming myth crafted along the lines of one of those old Rooney Garland, "Hey gang, let's put on a show" musicals. At the turn of the last decade, while still in college, two young married couples have the kooky idea of creating a magazine. A few wholesome, they are Mormon, hijinks, and one social media revolution later, they find themselves at the helm not just of a successful publication, but at the vanguard of a veritable movement, a zeitgeist-defining, social media-friendly tidal wave that swathes an entire generation in muted linen, poured over coffee, and gratitude. Hashtag kinfolk life, hashtag flatlay, hashtag blessed. There was a lot that appeared in those early pages that was an accurate expression of the lives of its young founders. Nathan Williams and Katie Searle met in 2008, while both were students at Brigham Young University's Hawaii campus. He developed a crush on the quiet, luminous girl after passing the desk where she worked every day. It would take him some time to get up the nerve, as he recalls, to ask her to leave her boyfriend and date him instead. Searle insists she already had broken things off with his predecessor, but both agree that she said yes, and then yes again a few months later when he led her into the forest and beneath a bower of carefully strung fairy lights asked her to marry him. An assignment for an entrepreneurship class had the two of them dreaming up an e-commerce platform, which they called Kinsfolk and Company, for selling plates and glasses and other things you might need for a sweet little dinner party. And that, combined with contributors Williams had gathered through a blog he kept and help from their close friends Doug and Paige Bischoff, gradually morphed in 2011 into a tiny, very DIY magazine focused on food and the small gatherings they all loved. They had no publishing experience and no defined roles at the time. Everyone just did everything. We all lived in married student housing, so when we weren't in class, we spent a lot of time together, says Doug Bischoff. We'd go to Nate and Katie's apartment, and they'd be at ours regularly. We were always getting together to cook and hang out and just enjoy each other's company. We had a really, really good friendship. Williams and Doug Bischoff even looked somewhat alike, both of them tall and lean, with short blonde hair worn in a neat side part, and a predilection even then for sharper clothes than might be entirely normal for your average college student. The theme for the first issue was inspired by a line from Thoreau's Walden. I had three chairs in my house, one for solitude, two for friendship, three for society. Williams so identified with the book that he handed out copies to friends at his birthday party. Kinfolk Volume 1 included an article on fika, the Swedish coffee break so in vogue now, and on tea time, rituals that would be incorporated into kinfolk's office life. It was really simple, really basic. But what I thought was sweet at the time, Williams says, and yeah, it was far too kitsch and cutesy, but there was this correlation there. From the start, Kinfolk pulled in millions of page views, a response strong enough to convince the Williamses and Bischoffs to sign on with a San Francisco-based publisher to help with printing and distribution. By September 2012, Kinfolk was selling tens of thousands of copies per issue at a cover price of $18. The two couples moved to Portland, Oregon, which in addition to being near Searle's hometown, had the added benefit of a large population of aesthetically minded millennials eager to express their creative identities through a well-curated table setting. Yet even once kinfolk had a real office and began hiring a real staff, the fairy tale quality remained. Nathan would bring in new bread he had baked, says Nathan Tickner, who started working as service manager in 2013. We had our tea time. At Christmas, we would all go out and chop down our office Christmas tree together. When Georgia Frances King showed up to interview for her job as editor, she was invited to join a staff party held on nearby Savi Island. Everyone from the office was there, sitting on the beach in the sunshine, swimming and eating watermelon slices with feta and rose water, she recalls. I thought, shit, it's real. What if your life may be shot in better light, maybe a tiny bit beyond your financial reach, but still, in essence, yours, turned out to be what an entire generation was dreaming of? 2011 wasn't that long ago, but when kinfolk popped up, it seemed fresh and new, Williams says. It was the first original concept publication focused on community, on coming together around a shared table, on slowing down. I think it resonated because it offered an antidote to the huge digital presence in our lives. As a company, we recognize that the more time we're on our phones, the more of an appetite we have for real connection. It was a strange transitional moment for lifestyle magazines. The great die-off had occurred just a year or two earlier, shuttering old stalwarts like Gourmet and Metropolitan Home, as well as livelier new titles like Domino and Plenty Magazine. A few of the more niche publications that rose in their wake, like Modern Farmer and Serial, lay a couple of years in the future. But by 2011, there was definitely a need waiting to be filled, as survivors like Architectural Digest and Elle Decor shook up their mastheads, and a number of upstarts, like Rue, still around, and Matchbook, not, debuted online. That coincided, as Portlandia so memorably satirized, with a new generation of DIYers. Seeing how it spread globally kind of astounded me, Cyril says. It was really powerful to see the map where we would hotspot what was happening all over the world. By 2014, the magazine had been syndicated in Russia, Japan, China, and South Korea. The founders had launched Our Media, a creative agency, had started a video series, and had published a book, The Kinfolk Table. They also started a series of gatherings, dinners or other events, designed to bring the kinfolk-minded together for some IRL, in real life, communing. And all of it articulated in an aesthetic so sharply defined, you could slice sourdough with it. The Martha Stewart living of the Portland set is how the New York Times referred to the magazine for a 2014 profile. 2 years later, Forbes named Williams one of its 30 under 30, and Underscore magazine compared him to Lena Dunham, noting that if the girl's creator was the voice of her generation, then Williams is the eye of his. Sometimes a publication catches a moment and crystallizes a certain thing that is happening culturally, says Mark Kramers, founder and creative director of FutureCore, a London-based digital design agency that works with magazines. It's going to be a mirror to that moment. It sees it, formats it, and delivers it in a beautiful package. That's what kinfolk did. That's not necessarily a good thing, according to Kramers. It's tasteful to a fault, he says of the magazine. There's nothing offensive, nothing that hurts your eyes, nothing that stands out. It's very beige. An AI bot could probably churn out the same stuff very easily. For the founders, that kind of criticism was missing the point. I always tell people that kinfolk is both an aesthetic and a worldview, says King. A lot of people only focused on the aesthetic. For the partners, kinfolk wasn't something they put on. It was their life. Searle was mystified by the way that part of the brand, the ethos, got lost. I had people coming up to me and asking, how do I join? As if there were some kind of exclusive membership, she recalls. And I would say, no, you just do it. You just invite some people over for dinner. But even actual dinner turned out to be complicated. When Kinfolk launched in 2011, Instagram was just 9 months old. In many ways, the two media converged perfectly, each seemingly made for the other. It wasn't long before millennial feeds were filled with the kinfolk aesthetic, even with the images of kinfolk itself. Somehow, I don't know how, the magazine became popular for social media, Williams says, taking photos of it on a coffee table, in a cafe, on the bookshelf. It just exploded. We started seeing lots of signature kinfolk photos, like the cone with flowers coming out of it to look like ice cream, pick up traction, and also go off on social media. The entrepreneur in him was pleased to have hit a nerve, but the soft-spoken man who loved Thoreau and was trying to say something about what mattered most to him was saddened. There were hundreds of thousands of posts that were tagged hashtag kinfolk or hashtag kinfolk life, but readers were receiving it as just a photo of a pretty table or an overhead shot of a cappuccino, he says. It became a beast that we had no control over. The same held true for those kinfolk gatherings. The whole point was to create a real community, but they weren't connecting at all, he recalls. People were just showing up to get a post for Instagram. We had to start asking them to put away their phones. So ubiquitous a signifier did kinfolk become that parodies popped up to satirize what they took to be its bland, elitist, and exceedingly white omnipresence. One site, The Kinspiracy, simply collected the copycat images from Instagram and published them beneath the tagline, Kinfolk Magazine, Making White People Feel Artistic Since 2011. It's not uncommon for people to characterize Williams as unlike anyone they've ever met. You know how people will describe someone as quiet, but when you get to know him, he's really deep, says King. With Nate, it's actually true. He can sit with silence. He can sit with space. He allows others to approach him, and then he doesn't so much unfurl as blossom. People just want to be near him, is how Searle describes it, which is exactly what Lance Anderson, Euroman's fashion director, remembers feeling when he first met Williams a few years ago at a party. There's a contrast there in that he's both extremely quiet and extremely charismatic. I've worked in this industry for a long time and know a lot of people, but I've never met anyone like Nathan. Yet charismatic is not the first word that leaps to mind upon meeting him. Williams comes across as sincere and direct, though there is a dreaminess to him that seems at odds with the steely determination beneath, and he is reserved in a way that makes his emotional range, at least in interviews, seem limited. There is certainly no triumphalism, and not really even much pride in his voice as he recounts kinfolk's early successes. And when he talks about the cracks that began to appear, they, too, are relayed with an evenness that makes you wonder if he is either repressing something or is just much more enlightened than the rest of us. Within a few years of the magazine's launch, both Searle and Williams were struggling with their faith. It wasn't an entirely new sensation for either of them. Searle's parents had divorced when she was very young, and her mom, with whom she is very close, came out as a lesbian and left the Mormon church herself. Williams' upbringing was more orthodox. He had grown up in a small, predominantly Mormon town in Canada, and his family was devout. But the 2 years, beginning at age 19, that he spent on his church-ordained mission unleashed some doubts. He was assigned to a district in Los Angeles, and although he worked hard and appreciated the discipline, the spiritual aspect rang hollow. I think that if you are truly convicted with your beliefs and you feel the importance of them, then of course converting someone would be very gratifying and rewarding, he says. I didn't feel that. I was doing it to do my mission. Among the many rules for missionary behavior is a strict ban against traveling outside of the geographic boundaries of one's assigned area. It is perhaps telling that although he says he was never rebellious, Williams broke that rule in his own way. I went to the Getty, he says, then pauses, a few times. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.